Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. President-elect Joe Biden has been declared the winner in Arizona, bringing his total in the Electoral College to 290 votes. A hand recount in Georgia will almost certainly confirm Biden's win in that state as well. Ever since he burst onto the scene with an upset Senate victory in 1972, Biden has been a power player in Washington and on the world stage, who will bring almost unparalleled executive and legislative experience to the job of president. Today on Midday, a conversation with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos about what kind of president Joe Biden will be. Osnos has written an unstinting and revelatory biography of the president-elect called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan Osnos joins me after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is Evan Osnos. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. In his new book, he takes an insightful and unstinting look at the president-elect of the United States. It's called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan Osnos joins us from Washington on Skype. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
And thanks for this book. It's a terrific book. It's really, really beautifully researched, beautifully reported, and exquisitely written. So congratulations. I'm a huge fan of this, and I can't recommend it highly enough. You spoke with Mr. Biden over a period of years on many occasions as well. You spoke with President Obama and a lot of people around in the political community who know and work with Joe Biden. When did you start covering Mr. Biden? How long has this project been going?
Well, it started, in effect, even before I interviewed him for the first time. I will mention that I became interested in him actually when I was a foreign correspondent working in China, and he came over to do some of his work as vice president. And there was something about the way that he conducted himself in those meetings that caught my attention. Specifically, he made a point of going out to a restaurant that was a kind of working class canteen near where I lived in Beijing. And that was quite a noticeable gesture. It was designed to, in effect, signal a bit of a difference of opinion about the role of transparency and rule of law in government, because the Chinese Communist Party at that point was contending with a series of corruption scandals. Anyway, I paid attention to that. I found it quite interesting that he made that gesture to do that while he was in China. And so then when I moved to Washington, I started interviewing him, went to the White House for the first time in 2014 and interviewed him, went abroad on trips, and began to find him to be in some ways, underutilized resource of insight into both the Obama administration, but also our political culture more broadly. And that's why I started going back and back.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, this is an unstinting look. You have a lot of good things to say about him, but you're not bashful about, echoing comments of his critics. It's interesting. One of the things that struck me was we heard a lot during the course of the campaign about Mr. Biden's clear and authentic empathy for people. But there are people who find him overbearing. They say he talks too much in meetings. Give us a lay of the land of what his critics say when it comes to, you know, his general countenance and his personality in these kinds of meetings.
Well, one of the things that became clear to me over the course of this research and talking to him and, of course, others, was that there have been these phases in his life that are quite distinct, actually, and he changes in ways that we don't often reflect in the usual reporting. And specifically, one of the things that he was sort of known for many years was that he was just he would talk simply too much. I mean, a very literal example, when President Obama, then Senator Obama, first came to Washington, they were in a committee meeting together at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Joe Biden, of course, at that point, Senator Biden, was chairman of the committee, and he's holding forth on some topic, as he was wont to do, and President Obama scribbled a little note and handed it to the aide seating at his side, and the note said, "Shoot me now." And then you fast forward a few years, and President Obama came to actually really respect the fact that Biden knew a lot about foreign affairs, that while he was, as a British diplomat once put it to me, a bit like a spigot that you can turn on but can't turn off, there was this real depth of knowledge to what he was talking about. And when it came time for President Obama to tap him as vice president, he really relied on him as an expert on foreign affairs and also somebody with a pretty subtle understanding of how Capitol Hill worked. And that was not something that President Obama himself, then candidate Obama, really had. He'd only been in the Senate for about 15 minutes and didn't really understand it in his bones the way Biden did. And when they got together finally at the White House, sort of on the cusp of taking power, as somebody who was involved at the time witnessed this and relayed the story to me, President Obama said, "Joe, I always want your counsel. I always want you to be the last one in the room. I always want to hear what you have to say, but I want to hear it in 10-minute increments, not 50. So there was a touch of them having to learn their way around each other, and it turned out to be a very productive partnership.
Yeah, at one point you write that in Washington, which was the windbag mecca, Mr. Biden distinguished himself, which is an interesting take. And you also you put sort of two possibilities. You say it's tough for folks to decide who's going to show up to a meeting. Will it be the Biden that's open and searching for perspectives that will help him be more effective? Or is it the one who talks at you because he thinks he has enough words and expertise to muscle through any situation? You talk about how people in a meeting in Ukraine, of all places, talked about how they got the Biden treatment, which is kind of compared to the LBJ treatment of yesteryear. Has this mellowed at all in the years, even since he's left the White House? Do you think he is that same person, or is he a different person?
That's such a great question, because it's actually really a key area in which I see change over time. Just in my own encounters with him, for one thing, he has cooled off a bit when it comes to this, what was for a long time this kind of very visible sense of eager to tell you everything that he knows about a subject. There's a little bit of the leftover chip on his shoulder from early in his life when he knew that some people didn't take him all that seriously. He was a young man in a hurry when he got to the Senate, and some of those habits of mind kind of held over. And what you see now is quite different, quite noticeably more settled. And I think there are a couple of things that have really contributed to that. He is a much better listener now than he was earlier. And I think one person who's very close to him said to me that, and this is a sad fact, but that the death of his son, Beau Biden, in 2015 of a brain tumor was a real turning point in his life. It quieted him. It settled him. It kind of humbled him a bit by the fates, in a way, that he was, he emerged, as this person put it, as a more, what this person said was it killed off the last bit of arrogance, that this was now a man who was a more reflective person. And you see that in your encounters with him. And more importantly, you see it in the way that he encounters the public. He's kind of these days very much on the lookout for information that he doesn't know and he doesn't have and that he thinks others might have. And he sort of hoovers it up. And so in a conversation, he really is genuinely trying to figure out, well, what do you know about this issue and how can I build it into my understanding of something so that I might be able to do this job a little better?
Well, that bodes pretty well, I think. Evan Osnos is my guest. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, a winner of the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. His new biography of the president-elect is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. So, Evan, it's interesting that you reported something that at least I was not aware of prior to reading it in your book, and that is that when Barack Obama approached Joe Biden about being vetted as a vice presidential candidate, Biden turned him down.
He did. He said, actually, Biden said to some members of his staff, Can anybody even tell me who Abe Lincoln's vice president was? Meaning, what is this job? Do I really want this? Is this a maker of history? Is this something that's worth it? And then candidate Obama went back to him and said, I hope you'll consider the idea again, Joe. And as Biden often does, he went to his wife, Jill, and they talked about it. And Joe Biden said, what Joe Biden said was, look, you've said that you are in this world, politics, partly because you care about issues of race and civil rights. It's something you've been talking about since you first got into this 40 years ago. And you're also opposed to the war in Iraq, which he had voted for after all, but had become a very vocal critic of. This is, you put our minds back in 2008, the end of the Bush administration. And she said, and you're being given a chance to bring both of these things into a better phase. How could you not do this? And he said, well, I get that, but I worry about having a boss. I haven't had a boss in 40 some years. I don't know about if I can, how will I manage being a number two? And she responded in a way that I think anybody with a spouse might recognize. She said, grow up. In a way, that was persuasive. And he ended up taking the job and becoming a very kind of visibly faithful number two. I mean, this is, you know, the oldest psychodrama in Washington is about presidents and vice presidents jockeying for attention and control. And you didn't see that in the Obama-Biden administration. They had they really did figure out a way to work with one another. And it was a partnership that neither one of them fully expected to thrive. And it really did end up working.
And you write that he reveled in the job. I mean, he came to really love it and was, you write about how he sort of was pinching himself all the time. You know, is this really me? Am I really the guy standing next to the president talking about this? Will that experience, that great emotional attachment he came to have for the job and his friendship with Barack Obama, will that completely inform his approach to Kamala Harris and her potential and her capacity and the kind of opportunities that he's going to give her in this administration?
Yeah, I think it's a key piece of it. And in fact, it tells us something really important, both about how he'll define it and then, of course, how she will probably need to approach it in order for it to work, which is to say that, you know, Joe Biden developed a pretty fully realized kind of theory of the vice presidency. When he came into the job, he actually didn't really understand the history of it very well. As he acknowledged to me, as he said, look, I thought I wanted to be a vice president along the lines of LBJ, who was, after all, the great senator and legislator who came into the White House and in theory was there to help this younger president, JFK, succeed. And what happened, actually, as Biden told me, he said, then I read Robert Caro's fourth volume of the great LBJ biography and discovered LBJ was miserable in the vice presidency because, to use Biden's expression, he wasn't in the deal. He really wasn't. He wasn't in the important rooms. He wasn't involved in the negotiations. They never had that key relationship. And that led Biden to conclude that really the vice presidency is only what the president makes it, what the president allows it to be. And in their case, Biden and Obama wanted a real vice presidency. He needed somebody to be a liaison to the Hill. He needed somebody with experience abroad because he didn't have those things. And in the case of his now president-elect Biden's relationship with Kamala Harris, the difference is he doesn't need Kamala Harris to be a liaison to the Congress because he can do that himself. And he doesn't need her to be an expert on foreign affairs. But what he does need desperately is for her to be a link to a new generation of Americans, a new generation of Democrats, a more diverse and in many ways more progressive cohort that has maybe was not as enthusiastic about his candidacy. And also, it's just not a world B that he really understands as well. And she's really important as a conduit to help him stay current, stay alert, stay hungry for new information, and also to be a voice and a face of the administration to the public. So I think that sets up the relationship with an important foundation to succeed. But one of the key features here that I think is important for Kamala Harris if she's going to work out in this job is Biden took pride in the fact that he never ran for office essentially from within the White House. He never did what some vice presidents often do, which is try to stake out some distance and use that position as a way to really position themselves for the presidency. He took pride in never doing that. And I think if Kamala Harris is going to stay close to Biden, that will mean being patient and mortgaging some of those ambitions until the day when it becomes the right moment, because doing it too early could undermine their partnership.
And that moment didn't happen in 2016. That must have been a really difficult moment for him and his friend, President Barack Obama, when it was clear that Obama sort of thought it was Hillary Clinton's turn and not Joe Biden's turn. How did he react to that? And of course, this is all happening in the context of his losing his son, Beau, which happened concurrently.
Yeah, it's a really painful period, actually. I mean, it's 2015. Beau Biden has died at the age of 46. And it was just an unusually close relationship between father and son. I mean, I think people have some sense of it, but the depth of it was really profound. I mean, Joe Biden often said of his son, he has all of my best qualities and none of my worst. And he was grieving. And in that moment of grief, he had to face the decision of whether to run for president again. And President Obama began to make it clear to Biden in private over lunch together that he really didn't think it was a good idea, because he thought, and he never phrased it quite this way, but it became clear that President Obama looked at Hillary Clinton's candidacy as the natural extension of the Obama administration. She too would be a history-making president. She too would be coming from a kind of an intellectual tradition that that Obama recognized. Biden, after all, is now the first Democratic president. He will be the first Democratic president to not have an Ivy League degree in a long time. So there were reasons why Obama was leaning towards Hillary. And the other piece of it was that he was worried about his friend Joe Biden. He thought, look, if Biden runs in this race with one hand tied behind his back because he is grieving the way he is, maybe it's going to end up as a disappointing end to a very dignified, decent public service career. And I don't want that for him. So he kind of, made it clear he didn't think he should run. And that was a difference of opinion. Biden was more confident. But in the end, it actually came down not to President Obama, but really to one of Biden's core advisors, somebody who is very much on the scene now. Mike Donilon was his chief strategist in the campaign. And Mike Donilon was at Biden's house one day, and he's looking at him, just looking at the grief etched on his face. And he says, I don't think you should do this. I don't think you should run for president. And that broke the spell a little bit, and Biden realized he was right. And it was the next day, in fact, that Biden got up in the Rose Garden at the White House with President Obama by his side, his wife Jill with him, and said, the time is not now, and I'm not going to do this. I can't run. And I think a lot of us have to wonder, it's hard to know what would have happened, the counterfactual of having Biden run against, if Biden had run against Donald Trump, how things might be a little different. What we know is that Biden was polling actually quite well at the time. He had lower unfavorabilities than Hillary Clinton. He was stronger in some of those key states in the Midwest. But it was not his time. And so he kind of slipped off into retirement. And frankly, I think most of us thought that was the end of his political career.
Evan Osnos, the book is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. We'll have more with Evan Osnos on the other side of a quick break, and we will take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @midday WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our show Monday, Our series on higher education continues with Dr. Deborah McCurdy. She's the president of Baltimore City Community College. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Evan Osnos. We're talking about his latest book. It is a terrific one, Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. My handle is @TomHallWIPR. So, Evan, how do you assess the strategy, which obviously was successful, by the Biden campaign in this last race? You mentioned that part of what they did was they afforded President Trump the opportunity to look like a racist and to look inept, and it spared him, who you described as a famously loose-lipped campaigner, the onerous task of slogging through a full schedule. It turned out well, but was this something that that took a lot of restraint, took a lot of thought on behalf of the Biden campaign?
Well, there were ways in which the circumstances, the very strange circumstances of 2020, were very fortuitous for the Biden campaign. I mean, for that reason, as you mentioned, Tom, you know, in some ways, having the constraints of isolation and having the disruption of the ordinary, really grueling schedule of going from event to event, you know, 10 speeches a day, every day. The fact that he didn't have to do that meant that he was able to be, you know, he was better rested, he was better prepared, he was more focused, he was less likely to generate the kind of constant headlines that are such a distraction, and you know, sometimes more than a distraction, substantive problems for a campaign. So that was one thing that was helpful. But I do think it's important to recognize that there were ways in which there was actual strategy, real strategy at work, that turned out to be important in why this campaign worked. You know, I think for one thing, from the beginning, there was a feeling in the political press that the Biden campaign was not paying enough attention to social media. I mean, they weren't real big players on Twitter. They didn't respond to every provocation and iteration that happened in the usual world of politics. And for that reason, they were often described as out of touch and kind of secluded. But as you know, the head of communications, Kate Bedingfield, said to me at one point during the campaign, she said, look, we're not going to spend every day on a Twitter war with somebody. That's not how we think this works. We think we should be paying attention to what real people are talking about. And that actually, that sounds a bit like a political cliche, except there's a deeper truth there, which is most Americans are not on Twitter. Most Democrats are not at the pioneering end of the party. They're not sort of the most progressive Democrats. If you look at the survey data, and the Biden campaign believed in this pretty deeply, most Democrats describe themselves as moderate or conservative Democrats, and they believe that's who they needed to speak to. And it was a curious fact that the most diverse, the most progressive in many ways, a Democratic field in history ended up anointing the most conservative, the oldest member of it. And I think for a lot of progressives, that was really disappointing. But it was also a reflection that oftentimes it's, you know, you have to run for the party and the electorate that exists now, not the one that may be dominant in 3 or 4 years. And that was one of the insights that the Biden campaign had.
And when Mr. Biden did leave his home in Delaware and he did speak, you had, I thought, some very trenchant analyses of the way he speaks. The first thing you say is that his oratory was unlike, you know, Kennedy or Daniel Patrick Moynihan, people he grew up with, or even Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. It wasn't a gift, but in his case, it was a product of labor. And that is because he struggled with a stutter until about the 10th grade. But you also say that his political success came from reaching people and not necessarily from these soaring speeches that we're used to from some other people. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, there's a really interesting distinction in the form of language that Joe Biden uses compared to some of his own heroes and his partner, Barack Obama. I mean, interestingly, the two of them forged their relationship, partly because they shared a big idea, which is they both believed, President Obama and now President-elect Biden, both believed that unity was not a waste of time. It was a real thing. You could actually try to appeal to the American underlying ideal that we are, in fact, this cohesive political community, and we really are bigger than the red states and the blue states, that it's not naive to imagine that. Now, in President Obama's case, of course, he had this extraordinary rhetorical power. I mean, just a combination of his literary instincts, his own personal story as being, in many ways, you know, these overlapping identities and chapters of American history all fused into one extraordinary story, that the combination of those two things allowed him to speak to Americans with this, now for us, sort of wonderfully recognizable and inspiring register of language. Biden doesn't go for the transcendent thing. That's not his approach. His approach is much more practical. What he says to me and has sort of returned to over and over again is the idea that people fundamentally understand their interests. And that word is really central to his calculations about politics, interests. That you shouldn't never walk into a room and tell another person that they don't really understand what their interests are. I think a lot of us obviously look at some of Trump's supporters and we think, gosh, they really are voting against their interests. But you never heard Joe Biden say to them that they were, for instance, morally debased, or that they were making catastrophic mistakes, or that they were, to use Hillary Clinton's word, deplorable. He never framed it in those terms. And that turns out to be a subtle way in which he allowed the field of play to be larger for him than it might have been if he had staked out the boundaries of these different communities more distinctly.
Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. That's the new book by my guest, Evan Osnos. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Evan, this brand, this image of Joe from Scranton, it's the real deal, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned he's the first Democratic nominee without an Ivy League degree since Walter Mondale ran in 1984. He graduated 76th in his law class of 85 people. When he won in 1972 and joined the Senate, that was an audacious and wild win. You call it one of the biggest upsets in Senate history. He won by 3,000 votes. He was always among the least prosperous members of the Senate, although he and his wife have earned, you know, $15 million or so since leaving the White House. But it's authentic, isn't it, that he is much closer to the folks in Scranton than he is to the folks on Park Avenue in Manhattan.
It is. I mean, this is the real thing. I can tell you know, sometimes it's hard when you look at it from afar. You look at Washington culture and you say, well, this guy's been there for 46 years. How is he not a kind of, you know, member of the most elite Washington circles? Anybody who actually is kind of close to the subtleties of this recognizes the fact that Biden's never really been in those center ring circles of the kind of most elite Democrats, the Clinton world, the Obama world. He's always just been a step removed from it. For one reason, it's a very practical and quite brutal fact that he started this process of always returning home every night to Wilmington, Delaware, because he was a single dad. I mean, after the death of his late wife, Nelia Hunter, and his daughter, Naomi, in that car accident, he had two boys at home, toddlers, and there was nobody else. And that's the reason why he started taking the train every night. And, you know, that eventually fed this image of kind of Amtrak Joe. And it's easy to, if you don't know the history, to think, well, then maybe that's just a kind of political shtick. But actually, no. I mean, it was just a functional fact that he had to be the dad in a family that had no other parent. And over the years, that meant that he was not a part of the Washington social scene. He wasn't, you know, constantly sort of elbowing for attention at those tables. He's hated fundraising. One of the complaints that you hear from his staff is that he pawns off the work of fundraising, doesn't like to do it. And you know, one person who was a former staff member of his who you know, wrote critically about him because he thought that Biden could be dismissive of his staff members also wrote, interestingly, that the truth was he was also uninterested in meeting with lobbying clients. He didn't want to play that game. And so even somebody who was critical of him had to acknowledge the truth was, I could never get Joe Biden to meet with my clients or meet with me. And it kind of drove me up the wall. So there's a piece of this that has always put him slightly apart from the conventional Washington scene.
As we speak today on the 13th of November, Arizona has been called for Mr. Biden. They are hand counting votes in Georgia. That will likely go to Mr. Biden as well. So his electoral college vote total will be probably about 306 electoral votes. I wonder, and we have the specter of Donald Trump giving an interview to the Washington Examiner that was published this morning saying that he was still going to win Arizona and Georgia and Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And he told the reporter, Byron York, never bet against me. And Mr. Biden's demeanor, to me at least, reminds me of the kind of no-drama Obama that we came to know in 2008. He is not rising to the bait here, is he? How do you assess his handling of this unprecedented election where he's garnered he's closer to, I think, 78 million votes now. How do you assess his handling of the response to this election that's coming out of the White House?
Yeah, it's really, I find it fascinating because there was a real plan in place. I mean, I was talking to Biden's advisors in the days before the election and afterwards, but the plan that they described in advance has turned out to be very much what they're doing, which is that they said, look, we know what this guy's going to do. There's no question here how Donald Trump's going to respond if he loses. We don't expect him to concede. We don't expect him to acknowledge the legitimacy of the race. He's going to do what he can to generate controversy, generate a dispute that does not exist. The law is clear, and as we've seen now, the vote counts are clear. Joe Biden won this election and didn't win it narrowly, won by a substantial victory both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote. And what the Biden transition has been vigilant about doing is don't allow yourself to get drawn into the invention of a dispute. You know, for there to be a dispute, you need two parties to tango. And he says, this is Donald Trump can say what he wants. That is not what matters here. What matters is the law. And I think there's a piece of the American consciousness right now where we are all so desperately kind of worn out and exhausted from whatever side we're on politically. We're all worn out from the last year, much less the last 4 years. And he has tapped into that recognition that Americans are ready for something more ordinary, something more normal. We don't need politics to occupy as much of our minds as it does. It shouldn't. Yeah, as somebody said to me who worked in the White House with Obama and Biden, this was in the months before the election was over, this person said, frankly, I think Americans are just ready to have a boring president again. And there's something to that. I think we're all eager to put politics back into a more sustainable place in our minds.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. We'll have more with Evan Osnos after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Evan Osnos. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. He has been a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine since 2008. We're talking about his latest book, a biography of the next president of the United States. It's called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan, we have a question about part of the world that you know a lot about from Peter. He asks about China. He says, how do you see Mr. Biden proceeding with America's relationship with China in waters that have been muddied by Mr. Trump's tariff wars?
Well, I think the case of the U.S.-China relationship, the Biden administration will break from what the precedent has been set by the Trump team, but in some ways will retain elements of it too. I think fundamentally the big difference is that the Biden-China team thinks that the solution to the challenge posed by China is to draw strength from America's alliances. And you'll see that unlike the America First period, in which the United States was in effect alone in a lot of its bilateral encounters with China, that you find that the U.S. is going to coordinate with the EU, with NATO, with Australia, with Japan, with Korea, with these alliances that it has around the world, and use those as a way of building its case for things that it needs China to do, like cut down on the theft of intellectual property and to open up market access and to stop the militarization of artificial islands in the South China Sea, things like that. And then at the same time, I think you may find, and that's a fundamental difference, I should say, in the way that the Biden administration would go about it compared to how the Trump team went about it. In Trump's case, it was this kind of improvisational, largely ideological approach where they would try one thing, see what happened. They didn't worry all that much about the impact on American consumers, of course, who were paying the cost of tariffs. So I think you also see, though, that that the Biden administration will probably retain some elements in the sense that they don't need to walk in on day one and give up all the leverage that they have inherited from the Trump even a chaotic Trump policy. So you're likely to see them say, fine, we're going to get rid of tariffs, but you have to give us some concessions in advance. You need to show us how this is going to work. Begin to satisfy some of the things you've promised to do, and maybe we'll begin that rollback. So they're going to, you know, they have what they have is actually a lot of, they have patience on their side. They don't have to do things tomorrow that will take pressure off the Chinese side. But at the same time, by no means are they going to carry forward what has ultimately been quite a problematic China policy from the Trump administration.
Evan Osnos is my guest. He's a New Yorker magazine staff writer. His new book is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. So Evan, of course, Vice President Biden and Senator Biden were both very involved in both of those parts of his career. He was very involved in foreign affairs. You write that even in meetings with foreign leaders during the Obama administration, that the body language often was that foreign leaders tilted more to Biden than to Obama, knowing that, that Mr. Biden, you know, perhaps had, in fact, a great deal more expertise than President Obama. And you also observe that unlike Dick Cheney, the prior vice president, the one immediately who preceded Joe Biden, Mr. Biden reinforced Obama's instincts for restraint rather than the other way around. How do foreign leaders see that? How do foreign leaders assess Mr. Biden's toughness, as it were, in terms of knowing, for example, he even opposed going in after bin Laden in that particular raid? I mean, do you think that's going to be something he's going to have to contend with?
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution in his decision making over the course of his career. I mean, earlier on, you hear him being more, he was quicker to call for the use of American power abroad. Some ways he's proud of it, and others he's not. So, for instance, he was a big advocate for the NATO bombing campaign in the Balkans, which he believes protected the lives of civilians, and I think it did. But he did, of course, vote for the war in Iraq and really came to regret that. And I think that shaped some of the choices he made in the years that followed. He was, for instance, he was arguing against the U.S. intervention in Libya because he thought that we would end up bearing the consequences for whatever was produced there. And when it comes to the bin Laden raid, it's worth pointing out that it was a sort of more of a subtle disagreement. I mean, he believed that the intelligence was not yet sound enough for it to be a safe bet. And he worried also about the political consequences for Obama. He said to Obama, if this doesn't work, you're a one-term president. And it did work, and it was obviously something they were glad to have done. Biden's talked openly about that. He doesn't sort of walk away from that. I think what you're likely to, and you've already begun to hear this, I tend to do a lot of reporting on foreign affairs, and so in my encounters with folks outside the United States in other capitals who are thinking through what a Biden administration would be like, what I very often hear is them say, we are honestly so relieved about the idea of a return to recognizable diplomatic functioning, the idea that we're going to be sitting across from the table from people who have some rudimentary knowledge of our part of the world. They, you know, understand the history of America's legal commitments and security commitments and so on. I think, you know, one of the more interesting examples of where these get complicated is China, because in China's case, you didn't have a single opinion at the top about what they made of Donald Trump. There were some, certainly, who looked at Donald Trump's confrontation with China and thought we would be happy to see the end of this presidency. But overall, I think the dominant view in Beijing has been actually Donald Trump was a great asset for China because he was doing such systematic violence to America's credibility that by the end of the Trump administration, the Pew survey showed that people around the world had higher favorability of President Xi Jinping and of Russian leader Vladimir Putin than they did of the American president. That has never happened in the history of that kind of polling. So they're in some ways, the Chinese, I think, are sorry to see Trump go.
You did ask him a question that's on a lot of people's mind, and that is about his age. He would have been the oldest new president in history, even if he had succeeded Barack Obama in 2016. I wonder, how did you frame that question to him exactly? Do you remember? And what was his response?
Yeah, I was quite blunt about it. I just wanted to know how he would decide whether he thought he was too old to do the job. And what was interesting to me was he's very open about it, talking about it. He sort of thinks out loud. And what he said was, you know, for one thing, he said a version of what we've heard him say before, which is, look, take a look at me. If you think I look like I'm too frail and old to do this job, don't vote for me. But, you do see anybody who's spent any time with him up close does see the fact that he is, frankly, sort of, you know, he's physically robust. I mean, the guy just happens. I describe him in the book as he sometimes looks like a grandfather with the flush of a who's just back from the gym. And that's often the case, actually. But I mean, as a more serious matter, he does look back at his father's experience, and he remembers that he encouraged his father to retire. And he thinks that was a mistake. He thinks that his father could have kept working well, and it would have been good for the business and would have been good for his father. So there's a piece of Joe Biden that was alert to that. And particularly after the loss of his son, Beau, he believed very deeply in this idea that you have to dedicate your life after a loss like that. You have to have a really deep sense of purpose, of getting up every day and doing something meaningful. Otherwise, you won't survive. And interestingly, after Beau died, Joe Biden received a gift from Ted Kennedy's widow, Vicky. She sent him a letter that Joe Kennedy, the father, of course, he'd lost three of his sons at that point. It was JFK and Bobby Kennedy and Joe Kennedy Jr., and was a kind of, you know, a tragic expert on surviving the worst possible thing that can happen to a parent. And he wrote in a letter to a friend, he said, you know, at some point in the depth of your grief, you find that only when you begin to envision all the things that these lost children could have done with their own lives, and you begin to see that maybe you can dedicate yourself to some of those purposes, that you begin to find some meaning in these losses, in these tragedies. And Joe Biden took that to heart, and he took that idea on board and really did begin to see himself as trying to express and live out some of the purpose that his late son Beau might have had if he had survived.
You write that he accrued a record, this is in the Senate, that to today's progressives resembles the counts of an indictment. I think that's a really good way of putting it. He's got an opponent in this election who won 71 million votes. The House had flipped 43 seats in 2018. And in this go-around, the Democrats lost ground in the House. They did not take control of the Senate. That may change, but as we speak here in the middle of November, they have not. Does Joe Biden have a mandate? And how do you think he's going to interpret the results of this election in terms of what he can do with his agenda?
Well, it clearly narrows the field of what's possible for him. I mean, if there is, in fact, a Republican-controlled Senate, then a lot of the more ambitious progressive proposals that he embraced, particularly in the months after the primary, become practically impossible. It also constrains some of his personnel choices. It's going to be harder for him, for instance, to get a Senator Elizabeth Warren through Senate confirmation as something like Treasury Secretary. So it has a huge imprint on what he's able to do. But I don't want to overstate it. I think there are still things that he can do with the power of the pen as a, you know, as the executive, that are meaningful, beginning on day one, like rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, like rejoining the World Health Organization. You know, these are both important in and of themselves. And then also they're indications of an American return to the world community after this period of seclusion and isolation. So I think you can look for him to find opportunities where they exist.
You quote Cornell William Brooks, who's a scholar at Harvard, as saying that the things that are disquieting about Joe Biden are the things that are disquieting about the Democratic Party in general. He's obviously going to face stiff opposition from Republicans and those on the right side of the political spectrum, but will he have a difficult time, this is the wrong word, but handling the left wing of the Democratic Party?
I think he will. Yeah, I think that's a real issue. I mean, there's going to come a point roughly 30 seconds after he's inaugurated when I think the progressive end of the party will begin to say, all right, the era of the unified front is over, and now we're going to really press and press and press. And I, you know, when I was writing the book, I had a chance to talk to President Obama about that phenomenon. And I said, how do you think, what's going to happen, and how do you think he should handle it, and how should the left handle it? He said, look, the left is going to push him really hard, and so they should. They pushed me hard, but they should push him hard too, because that's how our system works, and that's how they get their issues some attention. I think, though, that there will come a point when progressive Democrats will have to make some choices about whether or not they're going to essentially wash their hands of Joe Biden and say, well, he's not with us 100%, therefore we're gonna try to undermine him, or whether they're going to try to say we're going to work with him where we can and challenge him where we can. And I think there's an active discussion going on among progressives about how do we make sure that we are loyal opposition so that we're pushing him, but we're not actually limiting his ability to get things done.
Yeah, you describe it, the tension within the Democratic Party, as a clash between liberal meliorism, the long view politics of Obama and Biden, and the urgent movement that Sanders called a revolution. But you also observe that the Biden campaign placed a bet that when the pendulum swung away from Donald Trump, it was going to swing back to the center and not all the way to the left. Do you still believe that, given the results that we know?
I do. I think the reality is that, and it was Jim Clyburn, actually, the congressman from South Carolina, of course, the highest ranking African American in Congress, who pointed out to me, he has a principle that he's held on to for a long time. And he says, look, I call myself a centrist. And I know that that's not fashionable. And I know a lot of younger Democrats don't like it when I say that. He said, but my view, and I think this is Joe Biden's view as well, is that this country has a tendency to swing from one extreme to another, but that means it always passes through the center, and therefore we spend twice as much time at the center than we do at the extremes. And I liked the sort of elegant, pithy geometry of that idea, and I think there's a deeper truth there, that we're at a moment where we're so deeply polarized, we're not going to find something that satisfies everyone. But if you can create a compromise in the middle, you might get some progress.
Well, I'll tell you, I found this book very satisfying. Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan Osnos is the author. Congratulations on the book, and good luck with it, and hope we can talk again soon. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoyed it.
That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, it's Midday on Higher Education. My guest will be Dr. Deborah McCurdy. She's the president of Baltimore City Community College.
Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknell, and today it's Mark Gunnery. Rob Sivak and Sienna Greaves produced the program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Cogman from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. Reveal is up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.